All right, well, welcome back to another episode of Persuasion by the Pint. I'm Jonathan Taylor, along with
Sean McCool.
Sean, today we've got a really interesting guest. We're going to get into the process of learning and how to change behavior. Should be interesting.
Yeah, so you were talking about this before the show. You sent me an email, and you said this guy helped somebody go from 30K in their business to 300K in their business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Using these learning techniques, science, tricks, hacks, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever. Like, I was like, that's 10X. 10X, baby.
That is 10X. 10X.
Grant Cardone would be proud, except that I think this is probably easier than trying to do 10X more stuff. So.
Yeah.
So how to 10X your business without doing 10X more things.
Exactly. So this is it's a book called The Science, well, the subtitle is The Science That Is Transforming How the World Learns, Motivates, and Changes Behaviors. So we're going to be talking to the author of a book called, it's called Crack the Learning Code. He's going to be joining us shortly. Pretty hefty reading, like 700 page book, but he's going to give us the highlights of that coming up.
So how many pages would a highlight like of a 700 page book be?
I've got the table of contents pulled up here.
Yeah,
and I told him, I said I'm just going to kind of pull. We're probably just going to pull some of your chapter headings that sound really interesting and discuss some of those. And he's going to share some case studies from his from a lot of his research. Obviously, this is a compilation of research that he's done. And as he says, and he'll tell us, this is more than a book. It's an interactive, engaging, comprehensive system that reveals a whole new approach to learning. So he's developed, or his company, his organization, they developed the world's first scientifically based, multi-week program for, school parents. If you're a homeschool, if you're teaching your kids at home, so you can apply the learning codes, groundbreaking discoveries, but this also works for adults as well. Easier, yeah. For learning and motivating and changing behaviors. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you'll be taking notes with your teens in your house. Absolutely. Yeah. My, it's too late for mine. They're already gone. So they are on their own. But I could probably use this, and yeah, I'm sure. Yeah,
at any age, we're all still learning. And as we get older, man, our process for learning, it slows down a little. So we're all trying to, learn some hacks along the way that we can, apply and, retain information,
Absolutely. What are we talking about today?
Exactly. We're talking about beer. That's it. That's mostly what we talk about.
Yeah. So let's do a subtle transition to our beverage of the day.
There you go. Nice transition.
Nice hat, by the way. It is, as we're recording this, college football kicks off. It actually kicked off last night. Well, technically it kicked off last week, but those were teams were
That's right.
Not worth watching.
Exactly.
But the JV teams played last night.
Yes, that's right. A few local teams.
But yeah, the big game's tomorrow, so I'm excited for those.
And Sean's got his shirt. He's got his game shirt on. I've got my game hat, so he will be rooting for at 7:30 tomorrow evening.
Yes, for sure. Absolutely. All right, what do you have over there on your side of the world for your beverage?
So as I mentioned before the show, I realize that this is a football weekend, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the opening of college football. But I do want to share one that caught my attention today at the old local establishment. This is one from our friends at Terrapin Beer Company down in Athens, Alabama. So there's some tie-in, right? I mean, some sort tie-in of to the game tomorrow. But no, they've got a specialty edition. This one caught my eye, a six-pack on, it's called the Pastime Pale Ale, right? The Pastime Pale Ale. Okay. Look who's on the front, right?
Atlanta Braves. Is that Braves or is that the Braves or is that Alabama?
No.
You can't see the top, so you don't know if it's got the tail or not.
Yeah, I know, but that's the red that's and Braves. Blue. That's yeah. red and blue. That's not the crimson by any means.
Yeah.
Please don't be crimson. Again, the pastime pale ale from Boston via Milwaukee to Atlanta, Georgia, the Braves franchise has been playing professional baseball continuously for 150 years. That's a little baseball trivia there.
And, all right.
To celebrate, we have created the Pastime Pale Ale honoring this amazing milestone. Brewed with a unique blend of specialty malts plus traditional and cryo hops for a home run flavor. We encourage y'all to lift a pint and cheers to this momentous occasion. About 5.5% ABV and 33 IBUs. So it might be a little hoppy here.
Yeah.
Yeah, not one I would normally have picked, but considering the,
the
can that caught my attention.
I gotcha. I wonder if I assume they had to pay licensing royalties and all that for that can.
Oh, so. I'm sure they did.
Probably worth it. Probably worth the sales boost.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Speaking of, we'll come back to that, but it's all right. So I have an interstate lager.
Oh,
there's a lot going on with this. So there's like a koala bear or something on the cover, but yeah. it's a Texas company, Three Nations Brewing. Uh-huh. I could not figure out why they're called Three Nations. I didn't go that deep in the about page, but they're up in Carrollton, Texas, outside of Dallas. And it says, are you living life in the fast lane? Take the exit and turn your pit stop into a rest stop with Interstate Lager. I mean, a lot of cliches there in that one sentence. When you're done with your day's travels, put your boots up and kick back with an easy, repeatable, and invigorating brew. Repeatable brew. That's interesting. that was made for this day. So this is a lager. So it's only 4.9%, 30 IBUs.
Sure.
So I did bring a backup stout or something.
Oh, you got a backup on hand too, right?
I do. But it's one I've had before. So nothing to talk about because we've had it before or I've had it before. But it was down in the fridge and I was like, you know what? 700 page book. This could take a while.
Well, it's funny you say that because I just pulled out a backup too. And maybe we can talk about our backups near the tail end of the show. So,
okay. Yeah, sounds good.
But I'm going to put that one off to the side because this one's a little higher ABV. So,
yeah. Well, you know, this had a nice pour, nice head, you know.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of these darker beers don't have a lot of head on it. So, look at that. Yeah, yours is definitely got that.
The hoppy stuff.
That look. That look that we're not fans of. So we'll see.
The haze. I call it the hoppy haze.
Yeah, the only hazy beer I like is like Sam Adams.
Yeah.
You know, their go-to, their main one, whatever it's called.
Yep.
So, all right, well,
cheers.
Smells like a lager.
This one's, I can smell
the pine saw.
Yeah.
Yep. You sent me that picture of the pine saw IPA.
I thought that was perfect. Yeah. This one's definitely some pine saw. It's got some pine saw to it. I'll let you go first because I'm trying to decide what a fair rating on this is.
Well, I'm going to go. So this is a lager. This would be a on the lake kind of beer. Mm-hmm. Just because it's called an interstate lager, you probably shouldn't drink and drive with it. Just disclaimer there. Mm-hmm. But I think it's pretty good for lager. It's better than it's much better than a Budweiser, Bud Light, you know, any of those mm-hmm. big brands. It's got a little something else going on. So I would give this a 4. Even 4.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's good. It's got a little bit of a little bit of citrus or something to it, but not too much.
Man, I'm probably going to give this one. This was a below a 2.
And you'll drink it all, young man.
One of the ones that I will be giving away tomorrow to people that come over for the game. I'll I'll have a 5-pack in the fridge that says, you know what? You guys go ahead and take that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Help yourself.
Where are my IPA drinkers? There you go. Enjoy.
What's difficult around this time of year is the place that I go to, they normally start stocking. You're starting to see the transition, but before you get into the, you start getting into the stouts and porters part of the season, you have to, it's like a seasonal, or you transition from IPA season into the Oktoberfest season, which is pumpkin and Oktoberfest, pumpkin Oktoberfest, pumpkin Oktoberfest. So, so you know, I love October, some of the Oktoberfest beers.
Yeah,
don't get me wrong.
They're good. Yeah,
and,
they're good.
And even a few of the pumpkin, but I tell you, I'm glad when we get kind of past that phase. It's nice for a short period, and then I'm ready to get into some of the porters and stuff.
Yeah, I love some of the Christmas porters that come out at least around here with some of the other spices that are not pumpkin.
Yep.
That's pretty good.
Absolutely.
So. All right. Well, our green room is empty.
Yes. He should be coming on.
Yeah. For those of you watching live.
Check the email in case he's had any difficulty. I had to send him the StreamYard link like 2 or 3 times. It kept going into his, I think in his spam folder. So, let me send him a quick email just to make sure he's not having any problems.
I can read the back cover.
Read the back cover. There you go.
All right. So this is J.W. Wilson is the author. Discover the new scientific approach that is transforming how the world learns. Based on over 30 years of research, Cracking the Learning Code is a disruptive book that will forever transform the world's beliefs about how we learn, motivate, and change behaviors. This book is 700-plus pages of the most comprehensive learning reference available. It unravels the mystery behind how we actually learn and change. It is also designed so you can use a more scientific-based approach to reach your goals and live the life of your dreams. This easy-to-read book uses a unique approach. Once a broader view of a topic is presented, you will see these icons. Got little pictures of icons. Here you can choose to either skip to the next topic or read deeper to gain a more in-depth view. That's cool. This way you can learn at your own pace and continue to refer to this book as your ultimate learning guide. And this dude, I gotta tell you, like, he has more high-end endorsements on the cover and in the first few pages of this book. Like, he's got some serious testimonials here from a lot of different people. So, pretty impressive stuff. And, like, I just flipped through the index and it's like, man, there's a lot of... This is a textbook.
Is it Robert Kawasaki?
Kawasaki is the motorcycle, I think.
That's right.
Close.
The rich dad, poor dad guy, right? Should we call him? Let's call him.
Yeah.
Let's call him and see. I don't know. Hopefully he didn't forget. That might be a first. Catch him off guard. JW, you're on the air.
Reminds me, we got to bring back the prank calls.
That's right.
Hey, bud.
JW. Hey.
Yeah.
How are you?
Good. Yeah, I've got this down at 3:00. Do I have the wrong time now?
I think I said Eastern time on the...
Well, you did, but it was... Okay. So anyway, I'll go jump in.
No worries. We just finished our intro, so you can jump right in. We've already teased everybody up for your introduction.
Okay. I'm jumping in there, buddy. I'm so sorry.
Okay, no worries. Thanks. All right.
I tell you what, it's hard to get good admin help to give your guests the right information.
I'm telling you, our producer's fired. You're fired.
Wait till after the show. We need him through the show. So,
All right.
Hey, look at this. We got a YouTube comment that says, "Hi from Russia."
Hello, Russia.
Yeah,
that's a small world after all.
That is that's impressive stuff.
I can't read his.
I don't know how you say that name. I don't know what. Obviously, it's Russian.
Could be.
Yeah. What is there? Now I got to Google a picture of a Russian keyboard. It's like, man, what would that look like? It just blows my mind. So, but yeah, hi from Russia. So we're international.
That's right.
World renowned as what, you know, that's the copy phrase we would use from California. I know we have some people in California. Mm-hmm. So we could say from California to Russia. Yeah, oh, just popped in the green room.
All right.
Waiting on the video. I see his face.
That's right. Okay. JW, how are you?
Hey, buddy. It's good to talk to you guys. How are you?
Good.
I like the way you guys roll. This is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't get flustered by much.
Good. I like that.
That's the, I think that's the military training in both of us. Like, hurry up and wait. It's like, you know, it's like you, everything's urgent until you get somewhere. And then it's like, okay, wait here for 3 hours until we decide what we're going to do.
Are we recording, or can I ask you guys a question?
Yeah, you can ask. I mean, so
what were you guys in the military?
Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
I was in the old guard in DC. So I was technically infantry in the army, but I was in the old guard up at Arlington Cemetery. We did all the,
where that is.
Yeah. We did all the cemetery, all the funerals for Arlington. Oh, and then we did all the things around DC for tourist events and things like that. It was kind of, it was half the funerals and half like,
yeah, I went to school at American University.
Yeah. Yeah. So right around the corner from Fort Myer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. 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 And then Jonathan was much more,
I was in a 19, what they call 19 Delta, which is, we did a lot of reconnaissance work before battles. That's what we always trained, is doing recon work on the enemy and stuff like that. So
cool. Great. Yeah. Great.
And we were both in and out during peacetime in the 90s. So,
the closest I got was military school, which they threw me out of.
I quit. I was actually at North Georgia College in Dahlonega, Georgia.
Oh, were you?
And for about 2 quarters, and I was like, this is not for me. And it still ended up full-time military after that, but yeah, that was much easier than military school.
I went to Stanton Military Academy, and the guide arm there was Patton's son.
Oh God.
Which is pretty cool. Yeah.
That'd be hard for him to live up to.
Oh my God, the poor guy. I mean, that was in the 60s. That was only 20 years after the war.
That's right. Talk about
pressure. You know, so he was a big name, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Poor guy. Thank God nobody knew who I was.
Well, let's pick up. So we introduced you earlier. We'll splice all that together with the editing. You were giving us a little bit about your background. You can kind of tighten that up. And you were talking about, you had some experience on Madison Avenue. And
Why don't you start at the top? Because you were, even when we could hear you, you were kind of in and out. So if you would start it like at the very beginning, like your
background. Okay, and I'll just repeat the question. Yeah. So, I mean, what you guys are asking is, how did I end up getting here where I am today doing this, all this crazy research that took us 35 years? It took us exactly 34 years longer than we had planned.
Wow.
Shows you how good your planning happens. So I'll move really quickly. So we had some technical problems, so I'm going to kind of go over it for everybody. But what happened was, this is really back in the early 1980s. I read a book by Peter Drucker, where he talked about the Knowledge Society. When he said, we're no longer in a industrial society, we're in a knowledge society.
Right.
So what does that mean? Well, what that meant was that the new asset was knowledge. But what I recognized at the time was the systems we were using to get the knowledge didn't work. And the reason I knew is I ran, we represented, I think, 40 or 50 public, 65 publications worldwide, I guess, like the Washington Post, the Paris Match, the New Zealand Herald. We also had a couple of TV stations, Japanese and English, in partnership with Time Warner. And so we were always working with the marketplace. And what I found was, you know, some ads would work and some ads wouldn't. You guys know, as copywriters and ad guys, you know, you put something up and you hit a home run and you do the next thing, you know, same thing 4 weeks later. Damn, what the hell happened, right?
Yep.
And so what I saw, now I was really, you know, in advertising. I was in marketing. I started on Madison Avenue and then flew over to Hawaii. And so what we found was, that the systems that we were using to get people to change their behaviors and to buy something was all driven by neurobiology. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, I mean, this sounds pretty crazy back then, but what I saw was that what was happening to get people to take action, even at the time we knew this, we had to increase algorithms of dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine. And nobody had ever looked at the chemical underpinnings of how we get someone to do something in marketing branding. Now, there are some people out there that talk about, you know, here's what you need to do, blah, blah, blah. But I don't know whether how much time they've spent in marketing and branding or how much time they've spent in the research. And so, as I was saying before, I was going to try to do this all in a year. But as we started unwinding it, we started looking at the genes that cause learning. There's 6,000 of them. Then we had to look at the neurological structures, then the neurochemical systems. Then we had to look at quantum physics because the brain works off of quantum principles. Then we had to go to chaos and complexity theory because the brain works off of that too. So what started off as a simple idea turned into a kind of an odyssey that took 35 years that we're releasing the first book now called Cracking the Learning Code. To the whole world, and people in your industry, if you want to see how to change people's behaviors, this is kind of the opus. This is the primary document that we've done really pretty simply. We've written it so any schmo can read it. You read the first three chapters, and then you only have to read the first five pages of the next chapters, and then you can go deeper if you want.
Sure. That's pretty cool. Yeah, I was reading the back of the book before you came on, and the fact that you've got that reminds me of, like, what was it, the Dummies series books where you could kind of go deeper and had the icons for different things. I mean, that's I love those kind of books. Yeah. Super helpful.
Yeah, and what we found was, really, this is fascinating. We have this concept that learning is an event. You read a book, you go to a webinar, you memorize something, you take a test. That is all event-based learning. Mm-hmm. You went to a great webinar 5 webinars ago, and I bet you right now you can't tell me 3 things that were in that webinar.
I wouldn't be able to tell you what the webinar was 5 webinars ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So what that's called, that's because these are events. They happen. And what happens is working memory after about 3 to 7 minutes, even this one, people will get some good ideas. We'd like to have them get the book and go to the online, go to our website, thelearningcode.com, and see what we're doing in videos, mm-hmm. And how they can use it in their life. But what we find is that when we have event-based learning, like our whole school system is based on, and even our corporate training, I ran one of the country's largest training companies in finance back in the day, called the accounting game. And what happens is, in working memory, once it fills up after about 3 to 7 minutes, if you don't do something to let it go back to long-term memory where structural change is, in front is chemical change. You'll remember some of what's going on in this conversation. But what sticks is in your long-term memory, and the physical change is behind your ear in what's called the rear associative area. And we don't develop any of our online programs or any of our really learning programs to create the structural change that totally changes. There's no behavior change. There's no learning. There's no memory without that structural change.
Hmm. So you're saying there's this event-based learning. So what is the new type of learning?
That's a good question. It's really pretty simple. What do you remember? Your last history class or your first kiss?
It depends.
First kiss.
It depends. But Jonathan's such a stud. He's had so many.
He can't keep track. Well,
there's only one first kiss. So,
So what happened? Why is it you remember the first kiss? Mm. Well, reading a book and going to a class is an event. It doesn't mean you won't remember part of it, especially if the event is highly meaningful. I don't know if you guys are into... Are you guys into rock concerts or any particular things like that?
No. More so in my younger years, you get older, not as much. But
I mean, well, for instance, we're Marvel fans. We love Marvel movies.
There you go. Okay, great. You know? Okay. Then you can remember the characters. You didn't have to remember. Yeah. Now, there's something else. You can do these little blasts of information if if the information is highly, highly meaningful to you. In other words, event-based learning will work pretty well if it's really highly meaningful. So if you learn something about one of the characters in Marvel, you know, Captain Marvel or something that you didn't know before, it would stick. Why? Mm-hmm. Because it's already meaningful to you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do we get information into people that is, so what we encourage people to do is start with what's meaningful to you and then add new information to it. And then it can grow. Like if, imagine we were trying to teach kids something about science. Well, we would find out who is it, what Marvel comic book hero do kids love the most? And then we would, because we know that that individual is already in their brain wired, right? It's already, what you remember, what you connect to are made out of fats and proteins. These are neurons and synapses. These are the things between neurons, the connections between neurons and the neurons themselves. And it's like thick cheddar cheese. And when something is meaningful to you already, that cheese, that thick gooey stuff, those proteins and enzymes, that cheddar cheese-like stuff begins to add like a magnet. I'm using a lot of metaphors here. And attract information that resonates with it.
Okay.
So this is why you can remember things. I mean, you guys are into copywriting, you're into advertising. There's a lot of things that you guys learn there that will allow you to remember it without having to memorize it, without having to do anything. Now, so there's meaning first, but to answer your question, John, to answer your question, really learning is a process, not an event. It's the same way that seeds become flowers, coal becomes diamond, and caterpillars become butterflies. It goes through a process. We've eluded ourselves or deluded ourselves that you can learn through event-based learning. I mean, you can go to a class and you're going to spend an hour and then 3 days later or a month later, you're going to change from what you heard. It just doesn't work because what we found is information alone, and this is really important, doesn't cause transformation.
Mm-hmm.
What does? Well, what does is if information alone worked, nobody be fat. Because 70% of us all know calories make you fat, yet 70% of us are overweight. It did no good at all.
Yeah.
So what we found at the Institute is how do we change the structures? Well, we change the structures through a process like caterpillars to butterflies. And we found, this is kind of heavy stuff for the first call we're having with one another, but there's four stages: information, action, feedback, incubation. So, Jonathan, when you were a kid, your mother said, "Don't touch the stove." What did you do?
Touch the stove.
We all do it. It's like this idea that words are going to work is crazy, right?
Yeah.
So, as a little human being, you went over, either your mother said, "Don't touch the stove because it's hot." That's how you got the information. Or you walked past it. And then you went, "Oh, it's hot." Then your biology literally forces you to reach out and touch the stove.
Yep.
So that's action. So first is information. Then there's action. Then you get feedback, right?
Hmm. And
the feedback was what, Jonathan?
Ouch.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it was good feedback. It was different than the rest of what was going on. That created novelty.
Yeah.
It stood out. So now what happened, those first three stages, information, action, feedback, are driven by what we call in neuroscience the monoamines, dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine. They help you focus, which is what we, most of us in classroom, weren't doing. It was a hard time to keep our focus.
Absolutely.
So, when you're doing something like that, the first three stages drive focus. Now, if your mother would have whacked you in the head and said, "Jonathan, you're an idiot. I told you not to touch the stove. Go to your room." Well, the fascinating thing is stress, which is driven by your adrenal gland, which is under the corner of your ribs here on your right hand side. Basically, what happens is, right and left sides. What happens is when you're under stress, the hormone cortisol is expressed.
Mm-hmm.
And when too much cortisol hits the brain, it corrupts the learning. So if your mother would have put you under stress on that learning that wasn't you stress, self-induced stress.
Right.
If it wasn't that kind of stress, if it was external stress, literally the adrenal gland gives off a hormone called cortisol. It goes into the brain and shifts your blood flow downward to your least evolved part of your brain that makes it really hard to remember the information. Mm. This is why, I don't know if you've seen this before, that eyewitness accounts are so wrong. Because people are watching the eyewitness accounts of an accident or a crime, their stress hormones go through the roof, so their memory is corrupted.
Right.
So literally, we have an educational system based on making you take a test on what you memorized to raise stress hormone that corrupts the freaking learning.
Right.
Well, because we don't understand the process.
I'll give you a case in point. I've got two teenagers, and they both have different learning styles.
Right.
One of them, the youngest, is he's like a sponge. He absorbs everything. So sometimes I think he's got a photographic memory. But the other, the oldest, is not. He has a very difficult, he's more of a creative person. So he was stressed out last year because he was in a Spanish class. And it reminds me what you talk about with the stress and the cortisol levels, because his whole focus was on not getting called on by the teacher because he struggled. And when the teacher would call on him, it was stressful. She would like call on him and then ask him questions in Spanish. And he would not sometimes know the answer, but that's all he thought about. He thought about like the fear of being called on. So he didn't learn anything in that class whatsoever because of the stress just put him over the top.
So what I just told you, what we find is people blame teachers. I don't blame teachers at all.
No.
They're having to manage a system that they didn't develop.
Right.
Right.
Right. And it was started in 350 years before Christ, which right. with Plato and Aristotle standing in front of the room talking to you. Mm-hmm. Where, I don't know if you know this, but you know what the knowledge doubling rate was in the time of Plato and Aristotle?
No idea.
About once every 1,500 years. So you could memorize everything there was to know. There was only about 600 things back then, the stirrup and the spur.
Yeah, and what is it now, just for reference for people listening?
Once every 12 months.
Okay.
Wow.
So there's no way that you can use a system that was designed for 350 BC when information was doubling every 1,500 years in a world where information is doubling every 12 months.
Yeah.
You don't want to go to an eye doctor to cut out a cataract. The last time he learned something was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The technology is changing so quickly. You want the guy to learn something yesterday.
Right. Yeah. So the cortisol release is, I've heard that like you don't make good decisions or it's harder to learn new skills under financial stress.
Oh,
is that the reason for that?
Oh, that's why we make 70% of us are living paycheck to paycheck. Why? Right. Because the stress of not having money interrupts our ability to know how to make money.
Yeah.
Right.
So if you just got laid off because maybe your department is, you know, obsolete or it's, you know, the knowledge has changed.
Yeah.
And now you got to learn a new skill, but you're under financial stress. It's going to be very hard to learn that skill. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah. Now there's mediating things that you can do.
Right.
Meditation, mindfulness. So let's go back. So what's causing the stress, So let's go back. We got a system that doesn't teach us the way it should do, doesn't create structural change, which is what we're looking for with learning programs.
Okay. So
now you got 70% of us that are living paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. 66% of those people don't even like their jobs.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's huge numbers.
Right. So there's no importance to
there's
you.
No meaning. There's right. all learning, all behavior change, all things that make a difference in the world. You take Jobs, Wozniak, Dell, Allen, Ted Turner, Gates, you take Richard Branson. You know what their degrees are in?
Nothing.
None of them have a degree. Branson right. didn't yeah. finish high school.
Right.
What drove them to success was following what was meaningful to them. And what they found was the longer they might not have done this consciously, but what they find is the longer you're in the system, you're born with an overabundance of neurons in one part of you two guys' brain that none of the other 7.5 billion of us on the face of the earth have. Yeah. That give us a gift to see things in the world that other people don't. It's how we survive. We're tribal animals. So somebody had to be good at fire starting. Somebody had to be looking for the woolly mammoth if we were going to eat them. Somebody had to be good at all these different things, right?
Right.
So we've got this incredible diversity, which is just screaming out of us until we're about 7 years old and we're sent to first grade. And then we say, do you know how many words you learn by the time you're 7 years old?
No idea.
No, you haven't gone to class. You haven't really read a book. Some kids do. Most people have. Most kids haven't. You haven't really done much at all. You've learned between, depending on how rich your environment is with words, you've learned between 30 and 100,000 words from the age of 2 till about 6 in 4 years. How did you do that? Because those structures that dictated what was meaningful to you, whether it was music or whether it was Legos or whether it was soldiers, whatever it is you went to, it was driving you to learn more words so you could get more of what was already meaningful to you that stimulated that gift that upped your dopamine, your endorphins, your GABA, just made your life so much happier. So now you're learning all these words without doing anything. You're just chasing what's meaningful to you. Mm-hmm. And now we say, no, Jonathan, you sit in that chair for the next 15 years. You don't move. We're going to tell you what to learn and what to know. And we're going to tell you probably what you should be when you grow up. That's our
system. I'm having flashbacks.
It's true. It's rough.
PTSD going on here.
It's rough. It's very, and guys, I can't tell you, even for the A students, valedictorians, their levels of depression and anxiety are much higher than us because they fit the school system. But when they went in the real world, nobody cared how much they could memorize.
Yeah.
Yeah. And especially in today's world, because you can look anything up in 2 seconds. Like, you don't need to know how to you don't need to memorize.
No, and the problem is when you memorize, very little of it sticks.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's a lot of effort, a lot of energy expended to memorize.
I mean, not just from a traditional school standpoint, but, like you said, if traditional learning worked, you'd have less people going, or you'd have thinner people or richer people. You have people
going. It would all work.
It's like people are continually going to seminars, conferences, workshops. I mean, I know people that are literally perpetual. I mean, they're always at the latest events on learning new things. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it's
here's the problem.
Sometimes it's the same information, but it's just regurgitated in a different way, so it's.
And it just gets, we call it neural knockout. If you don't give that information in working memory, time to be selected back here to long-term memory, the next information just knocks it out. On our website there, I explain it there's a section for videos called The Noble Cause.
Yeah.
And you can go on there and see the way it literally gets knocked out of your head. You want to hold on to it, but physiologically you can't because the next stuff that comes, your working memory is like a workbench. You can only put so much on top of it until something have to get out of the way to put something else in. So if you keep knocking stuff out before you let it go back, you're in trouble. You can't remember it.
So let's say, for example, let's use copywriting as an example. A lot of people that listen, at least want to know about that. If I read a book on copywriting and I'm under stress because I'm trying to get better at it, I'm not going to retain much, but what little I retain, if I don't figure out how to shift it to the back of my brain, which I hope we'll get to in just a minute, the next cut, I'm going to feel like I still need more because I didn't really pick up that much. Exactly. And when I try to learn the next thing, it's actually going to knock the last thing I learned out. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
That explains so much of my life.
Me too. Listen, I graduated summa cum laude in criminology from American University, right? And I had to study constitutional law. You know what I remembered? How to find the bad guy, how to profile. I knew all that. Constitutional law, I don't remember one thing, right? And I graduated summa cum laude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just memorized. It was gone. Yeah. Right. But all that other stuff was meaningful to me. And really why it was meaningful is what I'm doing now in a way is detective work.
Yeah.
Uncovering how the brain works.
Yeah.
So there was a match there that I wasn't aware of. But to answer your question, Sean, that is what we do is event-based learning is going to knock it out after 7 minutes. So we've developed the first online programs in the world that don't go over 3 to 7 minutes long. And then what we do is remember those four stages, information, action, feedback. The last stage is incubation. If your mother would have left you alone when you touched the hot stove and not screamed at you, your brain would have dropped into what's called slow wave states. These are theta and delta. You might have heard of them. They're wave states that go anywhere from as slow as half a cycle a second to 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 cycles a second.
Right.
Alpha is probably the best known at about 7 cycles a second. But your brain has to drop into those relaxed states in order to suck the information from working memory, which is electrochemical, into structural change. So we've developed the first online programs in the world where we may tell you about the program information in the first 3 days, maybe 15, 20 minutes long. But then when you start doing the actions, we only have you do watch it for 3 to 7 minutes. And then we have you do something in the real world for 3 to 7 minutes that changes the structures, literally changes the structure.
So can you give us an example of what that might be?
Well, it would just be, we can go back to your touching the stove. I can go to other stuff too. But so when, after you touch the stove, since your mom left you alone, you wandered away, all of a sudden your brain broke into spindles of these alpha, theta, delta waveforms and literally integrated the information into structural change if your biology think you needed to know it. And for burning your hand, you needed to know it. So to come back to your question, John, so how does this work in the real world? What we do is, We are like this first thing that we're releasing is cracking the learning code for homeschool parents. There's about 1 billion homeschool parents now. We've got 20 online programs coming after this, like cracking the marketing code, cracking the cultural development code, cracking the addiction code. So they can see those on the website. But for what we're talking about here, for parents having their children learn something is what we say is, what we talk about is a part of your, for one of these modules, we talk about a part of your brain called the insular cortex. It's right here, really kind of above your ear, kind of between your temporal and your parietal lobe. And what it does is it helps you want to grab onto stories. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it was this is why story, you know, Sean, you're a copywriter and you know that stories can have a very powerful impact on people. Why?
Yeah, we've talked a lot about that on the show, so I'd love to hear.
Oh yeah, sometimes we go on the show, I can break it down into the chemistry. I'll go crazy on this. So what happens is this insular cortex is right here, kind of behind and above your ear. When that's fired, this is what's so fascinating about understanding how all this complex biology works. We can learn a lot by going back to evolutionary biology. Where did that structure come from? Why was it designed in the first place? Well, when we lived in groups of 25 to 50, and we didn't have writing, we didn't have books, everything was word of mouth or even sign language up until about 150,000 years ago, when we really got kind of finite language. What happened was I would go to the water hole and I'd see a saber-toothed tiger and I would run back to my tribe. Now, the only way for them to learn, if I didn't tell them a story, was for them to go see it. So I came back and I started telling the story about what was going on at the pond with the saber-toothed tiger because it was highly meaningful to my tribe members not to get eaten.
Right. So let me see if I can unpack this a little bit. So you wouldn't just give them a piece of information, a saber-toothed tiger almost ate me. That's not very valuable, right? I mean, it sounds valuable on the surface, but without the context of the story, it doesn't land.
Perfect. And here's the other part. You've got a part of your brain called the amygdala. The more powerful I can... Damn, you're shifting beers on me there, dude. What are we drinking now?
Dude, we just keep going on this show.
It was a lager. Now what do we got? We got something a little heavier there.
Don't yeah,
we?
I went from 4.9% to 10.2. No, all right. It's nothing personal. It's just what I do.
Now, do you guys have Motorman Helper underneath you where you can pee in a bottle so we won't notice?
Nope. Don't have that. Nope.
You guys are strong.
If the screen goes blank, that's where we go. You just keep talking.
I'll cover for you.
There you go.
We'll be back in 60 seconds or less.
Exactly. So I have no idea where I was. Do you know where I was?
Amygdala.
Okay. So, yeah, it was too emotional for me talking about your bladder. So what we find is that there's this part of your brain called the amygdala. It's in a part of your brain called the limbic system. It's right in the middle. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it drives emotion, drives happy, sad, anxiety, anger. It basically controls all of our emotions. It's like a spice rack that needs to be sprinkled on to any information and for it to be remembered. If it's not going through your emotional center, you ain't going to remember. Now, a lot of I talk to engineers, just a quick side. And I'll tell them this, and they'll go, but Mr. Wilson, a lot of these guys are from India, Mr. Wilson, he told me not to be emotional, that I should not be emotional as an engineer. I said, dude, it's wrong. Without emotions, there's no learning.
Yeah.
You remember what's emotional to you. So to come back to it, what we found was that when you enter this cycle, information, action, feedback, and time off, if the information is meaningful and if it's emotional, it's going to stick. You don't have to do anything else. So going back to our ancient Homo erectus or Homo habilis, whoever the dude was, he's wandering through the woods. He sees the saber-toothed tiger. He comes back and he tells the story with what? Emotion. Hmm. And that is so vital. The brain needs that stuff to hold it. It's like Velcro. If you can throw the emotion into your story, it's going to stick. But it just can't be any emotion. And this is where we get into meaning again. It has to be meaningful to the person who's listening. Right? So in other words, if I'm telling a story that's emotional and it's about fly fishing and nobody cares about it, nothing's going to stick. But if I hit what we call the meaning network of my customer, and another time we can discuss what the meaning network is and how you can activate that as guys in marketing like we are.
Yeah.
What we find is that when we can hit what's meaningful to them, jack up the emotion, they move. This is where motivation comes from.
Well, this reminds me, JW, this reminds me of Zig Ziglar, and he used to talk about sales as a transfer of emotion. Mm-hmm. Right? And he would talk about how if you can tell a story around whatever it is you're selling, you know, for him, it was pots and pans or, you know, whatever, you know, if you can transfer the emotion of preparing that meal for your family, I guess what you're saying, tap into that meaning network, you know, that's, and you transfer that emotion from one customer to another through story. That's really, you know, successful.
Stories are like a virus, you know, Hansel and Gretel. I mean, I tend to equate learning a lot of times with the virus. Nobody's wearing bell bottoms today. Why did that happen? We have neurons called mirror neurons that force us to follow the herd, mm-hmm. whether we're aware of it or not. And when we can pack some of our copywriting and some of our marketing into these three things, like, you know, meaning, emotion, and the customer is already doing it some level, which we already know it's already meaningful to him. When we can tie all that together, they don't unbond from you. Physiologically, they then see you as a mentor, somebody that can take them from pain island to pleasure island. And that's what we want to do in marketing and branding. How do we pull the guy from pain to pleasure? And what we don't do is we don't take a lot of time researching who is our perfect customer and then reverse engineered the words that will blow him away at an emotional and a meaning level.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it was Eugene Schwartz in Breakthrough Advertising. He talked about you don't create desire, you tap into the desire that already exists.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So then you tap into that meaning or desire that exists. You throw some emotion in with a good story, and it all fires the chemicals and does all the things you're talking about.